Let's do a podcast. Let's do a podcast. Let's do a podcast. You guys. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Mundane Festival Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lambert. Today is Sunday, March 18th, 2018. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, and on Podbean, the host site. If you like this show, please rate and review it on iTunes and or Stitcher. Give it a 5-star review. Let everyone know why you like it, because it will make me feel good about myself and most of the life decisions that I've made so far. You can email the show at mundanefestivalpod@gmail.com. Let me know what's on your mind. More importantly, what's on your heart. You can like the show on Facebook. You can follow it on Twitter at Mundane Festival. And you can follow me, your host, the guy talking to you right now, on Twitter at Chris Lambert. This is episode 270. I have a very special guest, writer, blogger, film critic, Aaron Hundley of EssentiallyAaron.com. Sharing that with you in a bit. Right now, I'm not in my apartment. I'm sitting here in my hotel room at the Radisson in beautiful downtown Hartford, Connecticut. Just got done doing a weekend of shows at City Steam Cafe. They have a comedy club inside of the building. City Steam is a brewery, and in their downstairs area, they have a comedy club called the Brouhaha Comedy Club. And I had a great weekend. Shout out to the homie Keith for coming through, bringing his lovely wife. They came to the first show, and it was very kind. It warmed my heart that he came. I almost cried in front of him and his wife, but I held back. It was very nice to have someone rooting for me. So that was very cool. First show was great. Second show was really fun. The third show was work. It was like there was a drunk table, people that have been drinking upstairs at the bar for like, I guess, probably the whole day, and they were being disruptive. I said some shit to them for a little bit, but it's just that little terrorist cell of one table can ruin the whole show for everybody. But I got through it, but it was just more of a slog. It was just like everybody was, except for that table, like, and it's weird because like they're having a good time, but then they're ruining the show. But then they're having a good time and they're ruining the fucking show. And the rest of the crowd, they were into it. They had a good time. But yeah, it kind of sucked that it ended on that note. But we got through it. That's what happens. Fucking showbiz, you know. Let's see what else. Earlier this week, I had a really cool audition for a Netflix show that's like a 4-episode arc. And that was fucking cool. I had to shave for it. And I, like, because I was auditioning to play a real guy. And that was pretty neat. And he didn't have any facial hair. And had, like, an accent that I had to do. It was pretty neat, man. It was cool to be in the mix for something that's pretty substantial as opposed to, like, a couple lines here and there. And it was pretty neat this week that so the episode that I did, Jessica Jones premiered season 2, and my part is the male nurse. I gotta get the guy's name that he shouted me out, like someone. Hold on a second here. So earlier this week, this past week, I guess this guy's a podcaster, Patrick Monahan. He tweeted, he did like, I guess, he recorded like my little brief moment and where I'm, up against the wall and, eating Utz potato chips. And he says like the best thing in any, this is extreme hyperbole. In a year that Black Panther came out, he writes, "The best thing in any Marvel property is this guy getting visibly disappointed that there are no more chips." And And then someone, if I can find this, I hope I can find this, so I can, a fan of the podcast, a listener, said, I think he said, put some respect on Chris Lambert's name. And that's how I saw it, because I didn't know. And I looked it up and I was like, oh, cool. Let me find this. Brand, shout out to Brandball on Twitter, Brandball. He hit him up and said put some respect on Chris Lambert's name, and then people were tweeting it and stuff like that. So that was pretty fucking cool. That was a nice little moment that I, as an artist, that I discovered on set. So I was just like, that was pretty fucking cool. So it's nice that that people like that appearance. There's more to come, folks. That's all I say. I'll say around this time, mid-April, you'll see some more shit with me. So that was really neat that people liked it. And so that was fun. This week you can catch me on, well, I recorded an episode About to Review with that guy named John. He talked about a foreign film going to the Seattle Jewish Film Festival. Talked about a movie. I talked about Gringo and Thoroughbreds. So that's episode 99 of About to Review. And that's wherever you listen to podcasts, you can find that. And if you go to my Twitter timeline, I've tweeted it and all that good stuff. Also, I don't do enough to plug the Patreon page, but there is a Patreon page. I have a Patreon page. It is patreon.com/mundanefestival. And recently, I think the latest thing up there is me talking to Sarah Tolomash from Vag Podcast about Thoroughbreds. And she was fucking great on the show. I have to get her back. I know some of you have hit me up and telling me how much you enjoy her. I texted her yesterday and I was like, hey, people love you on the show. Got to come back. Since she's a Blumhouse fan, maybe we'll get her back for that Truth or Dare show movie with Lucy Hale and get her to break down that movie. I'm sure we'll have some fun with that one if she's able to come back on that. So check out the Patreon page. It's cool shit on there. I put a whole set of mine from 5 years ago opening for Chris Hardwick at the 930 Club. 930 Club bootleg. And there's tons of other stuff, movie reviews. And again, like I say, even if there's movie reviews on there, and it's not your run-of-the-mill movie reviews, because there's stuff that I reveal about my life in some of them that you probably haven't heard before. That's pretty interesting and fun. It's some pretty deep conversations that we have. It's not like, you know, I'm not saying it's next level, but it's behind the paywall. Check that shit out. It's good. What else, you guys? I did see some movies while I was up here. I saw Tomb Raider and Love, Simon. Liked them both. I enjoyed them both. I don't know what the deal is with people, some film critics and video game, like, I don't know that some of these film critics actually play video games. I was talking to John from About to Review, and before I went to see, he's like, yeah, it's good, it's a good video game movie. And a couple other people that I know, like the people that I know around in the podcast community, there's kind of this consensus that it was a solid movie, and I enjoyed it. Like, I really liked it. But if you watch this movie and you've played the last two Tomb Raider video games, it's like, okay, yeah, this is a video game movie. Like, when she's running around with the bow and arrow, that's like the video game. There's like, she's in this tomb and there's spikes rolling around and she's ducking them and she's sliding under them. There's a dude chasing her. That's like one of those cut scenes where you got to press the triangle button at the right time so she avoids it and doesn't. That's like the fucking video game. She's solving a puzzle. It's fun. There's not much to it. It doesn't have to be Citizen Kane or Moonlight. It's a fun It's a fun movie. So I enjoyed it. And it's worth seeing, especially if you're a gamer. Alicia Vikander is really good. She's a really good Lara Croft. I think it's Lara. They call her Lara. Lara Croft. That's how they say it in the movie. And that's how I think she did it in an interview. She said it's Lara. So I dug it. It was dope. Was it dope? I dug it. It's good. It's a satisfying flick if you played the games and you want to have a good time. Love, Simon. I want to talk about this a little more with somebody. So maybe I'll have a chat with somebody on a Patreon episode. But what I will say is that it's a good movie. It's a really good mainstream rom-com with a queer lead that most of the coming out or just gay queer movies of late have been just like fucking long, drawn out, like sad and laborious. And it was decent to see, even though there were some shitty things that happened in this movie. But it's the same shitty stuff that happens like in 10 Things I Hate About You, but a lot darker, because 10 Things I Hate About You was like almost 20 years ago. I'm just saying that because it was on in the hotel for the last two nights. But it's a step in the right direction as far as making this stuff, making it mainstream. But there's so many art house movies with LGBT stuff in it, LGBT stuff that's really just like, this is fucked up, and this kid is having a hard time doing it. And not to say that the kid in this movie, he has a hard time, but it's not as dark. So it is good, but I wanna talk about that with someone else, hopefully. Before we get to Aaron, I wanted to say, if you're in the Pennsylvania area, get tickets for my show at Steel Stacks in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. It's going to be a fun time. I might be wearing a new shirt or something, and I'll have some jokes for you. And Darren Patterson, friend of the podcast, is opening. So it's going to be a good time. All right. And so I want to give you a talk about a movie that I think was really cool, because the homie Damian Lemon is in it. It's this movie called Furlough, which stars Melissa Leo and Tessa Thompson. And I'll read you the blurb. A young woman works part-time at a prison while also caring for her mother. The rookie guard gets a chance to prove her mettle when she's tasked with accompanying a hell-raising inmate on an emergency furlough to visit her dying mother. But things soon spiral out of control, sending the pair on a surprisingly touching road trip. It's a nice little like comedy. I got home from the club early Saturday, like late Friday night, and I was just like looking for stuff to something to watch, like something to rent or maybe some Netflix or something. And I just go on iTunes and I'm looking to see what's new. And it's this movie Furlough. I thought like, okay, this is going to be like in theaters, and it isn't. It's currently in theaters. I think it's actually playing at the IFC Center in New York City, but it's on iTunes. So this movie is on demand and it's also on iTunes. And I was like, shit, I'm renting this, because I knew Damian was in it because he and I were talking about this last year, and we were texting each other about something, and this came up, and I was like, shit, dude, like your movie's out now. And we were texting about that, and I was like, oh shit. So I don't want to spoil anything. I didn't spoil anything, but I just took a screenshot on my Instagram and talked, the shit, like where I do the same shit that some people do on social media when their friend is in something. But I was like, it was really fucking cool to see him in this movie with Tessa Thompson. like a dope ass, like she's a bona fide star, and one of your buddies is in a big substantial sequence of the, not a scene, a fucking sequence with one of the top black actresses in the game right now, if not the top. Like, so it's really fucking cool, and it's a good movie. It's like a sweet, good movie. Like, Whoopi Goldberg's in it, and she's got like Lala's in it, and it's just like a, like they're like supporting characters, Lala and Whoopi Goldberg, but it's fun. It's like a, it's a sweet, charming movie. It's kind of quirky. Damien's really good in it. Tessa, like if you like Tessa Thompson and you like my reviews of movies, you like my taste in movies, it's nice. It's just a nice, satisfying rental. And it's $6.99 on iTunes to rent, and you can't go wrong with that. What are you gonna, like, if you go to the movies, it's gonna be $15. Like, any movie you see is gonna be $11 or $12. So I say you can't go wrong with it. Hashtag black actors. So check that out. And let's just move on. Let's get to Erin. Erin Hundley, I found out about her through John, that guy named John, and the homie Tim Hall, about to review, I found out about John from Tim Hall. So Erin would come on there, that podcast a lot. I loved all three of them together on the show when they're shooting the shit, talking about movies, playfully making fun of each other. And I've been meaning to get Erin on the show for quite some time, and glad that she's a very interesting lady. She's got a lot of cool stuff going on. She's very talented, and you'll get to know more about her. So make sure, if you like Erin, check out her, you know, follow her on social media, check out her website, Essentially Erin, and enjoy this conversation with the lovely and talented Erin Hundley. So Erin, I was scrolling through Facebook this morning like I normally do, and I saw a post that you had about you being on American Idol. I didn't know that about you.
Oh, yeah.
How long
ago? I did it twice, actually.
Oh, really?
I did it season, I did 9 and 10.
Okay.
So I did 2009 and then the following year's season as well. 2009 was the first one that I did.
What was, so you're a flat out vocalist then?
I would like to say yes, but I would probably at this point say I used to be. I really miss it a lot. But Idol kind of broke my heart in a lot of ways. I never sang, I had always grown up, you know, I sang at church and everything like that. And I had, you know, sang in the shower, and I loved singing musicals and, you know, being in plays and things like that. But I'd never sang, you know, like modern hits and modern songs and things like that. And I never liked being, you know, flat out center in the spotlight and everything like that. And that's really what a lot of Idol is. Mm-hmm. And so the first year, I did it because my dad dared me to.
Oh.
Okay. And so, yeah, it was in Dallas, and we lived in Keller, Texas, which is maybe like 20, 30 minutes from Dallas. Like, it's not that far. Okay. And my dad was like, well, it's too close this time for you not to go, so I dare you, let's just go. And it's like this huge cattle call audition that takes up all day, and we were the first people in the new Dallas Cowboys Stadium.
Nice.
And with between all the people that were there for audition and support, we filled up over half of the stadium. Wow. So it was a full day. Yeah. And what they don't tell you on TV is that you actually have to go through like four rounds of auditions before you even get to meet the celebrity judges. Mm-hmm. And so went through the first round, got through it, and went through all the subsequent rounds, eventually made it to the judges, and got sent off to Hollywood Week the first year. And I feel like every single audition I ended with, okay, like that was cool and all, but I definitely don't think I'll get past the next one. And then it just kind of kept happening.
Well, let's go back.
And
let's go back a little bit. So the four rounds, what did you sing? And like, what were the parameters of the audition? Was it just like a couple bars? Was it, You got 30 seconds to sing your heart out. How did the first, so like the cattle call thing, and then
yeah, you really don't, they don't have, like, they tell you 8 to 16 bars, if I remember correctly. Uh-huh. But what happens is they essentially just brought people down in sections. In the very first audition or the first round, you're introduced, like, you're singing in front of, like, really low level producers for the show, assistants, you know, people that aren't working in the music industry but work for NBC or American Idol. Mm-hmm. And then they bring you up. There's like a, if I remember correctly, like on the, where the field would be is like, there were like 13 different tables set up, and each table had two quote unquote judges behind it, which were these producers.
Yeah.
They brought you down in the sections of the stadium and like sifted you into these lines for each table. And then for each table, there was a row of four people, and you'd step forward, sing your little bit, step back, and each person would go. And then the producers would say, okay, we want number 1 and 3, or, you know, we want all of you, or sorry, you know, thank you for coming out, but none of you get through.
Gotcha.
So I sang Ain't Too Proud to Beg by The Temptations for all of my auditions that year.
Okay.
And because I was, how old was I? I was a sophomore year, so I think I was 19. It was about 19 or 20. And so legally, if you were not a minor, you weren't allowed to have parents present whenever you got through each round. And I'm the kind of person where I'm really smart about stuff like that. So I'm like, I'm not signing anything without a parent or legal representative there. And so even though I was not a minor, we kind of like lied to them and told them that I had a medical condition and my father had like all of my medication, which technically was not a lie because he did have my inhaler, which is medically prescribed to
okay,
me.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like really a lie, but he got to come back with me. And each round that you get through, you have to sign a bigger and bigger contract. Mm. And if you've worked in the industry at all, which I know you have, like you're aware of how sometimes unbelievably ridiculous those contracts are.
Sure.
Well, by the time I actually got to Hollywood Week, like when I got to, or no, the rounds for the celebrity judges, I had to sign a big contract. I had to have all of my immediate family members had to sign this contract. Essentially, it's a standard NDA more than anything else for your family, just to make sure that nobody ruins what's going to happen on the show before it actually airs.
Right.
And then I auditioned, and they give you like this giant thing full of like this, literally it's like the size of a novel of approved music that you can sing once you get the Hollywood Week, because there are artists and things like that they got permission to use their music on TV and stuff like that.
Gotcha.
So once you get past the Hollywood Week or the celebrity judges round, it's usually like several months before you go to Hollywood Week, and it's like they pay for the hotel, the flight, everything to get you out there and to get you back. So I think it was, the auditions were over the summer, and then we flew out like in October for Hollywood Week. And so I actually had to finish my entire semester worth of schoolwork on my own. So I had to take all of my finals before I left. And like, I taught myself the latter half of the semester while still learning the current half. So it was really difficult, and my grades 100% suffered. Mm-hmm. But, my dad, you know, bought his own ticket and he flew out with me, and it was an unbelievably crazy experience. And I got through the first round of Hollywood Week, and I sang Many the Miles by Sarah Bareilles. And one of my absolute favorite moments that was actually aired on television was like the closing of that episode. And I still don't know why they use it, because it makes no sense. But the closing part of the episode, like as they're cutting to commercial, you like see me like crying and happiness walking off the stage. And I can hear my dad like woo-hooing in the background. So I just yell like, I love you, Daddy. And then like cuts to commercial. So it was really cool.
Well, that's why they would use that. You answered your question. Answered right there.
I mean, it was cool for me, but it's like, it just doesn't, it seems like somebody telling their parent that they love them is like a strange thing to end a singing show on, I guess, in my mind.
Oh, that's gold. That's reality TV gold. A nice, genuine moment. A nice, genuine moment on a reality TV show. I was just watching this show. I don't know if you've ever heard of that Lifetime show called Unreal, about the fake, like about the reality show, like the Bachelorette.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy, but it's just like it's supposed to be.
Does it just pick apart reality TV shows or quote unquote reality TV?
Yes, yeah, like so much so. It's a nighttime soap. If the Bachelor or the Bachelorette was a nighttime soap, it would be that show. And I don't even watch those types.
That's
of
awesome.
Shows. And for me, like that had to be pretty nerve wracking doing that, right? Audition, because I can't even watch American Idol, The Voice, or Last Comic Standing, any of those shows, because I just get to, I have so much anxiety watching those. I can't do it. So for me to be just a viewer, it's hard. So it has to be kind of mind wrecking to actually be performing on a show like that.
I think the first year it really wasn't as much, because I think the first year I really did not expect to go that far. Mm. So I really had no expectations going into it. And since I was there on a dare, it wasn't really something that I don't want to say that I didn't want, but just not something that I was like, oh, this is my life plan. This is what I was made to do. So I didn't have a whole lot of pressure on myself for my beginning auditions. Now, when I got to Hollywood Week, that was something completely different. I should have bought stock in Pepto-Bismol, because I swear I was chugging that stuff by the bottle.
Now,
it was so bad.
Now, so you made it through to Hollywood Week. And what was that? What was that like? Like the round was like, how does that work? Like you, how far did you make
Hollywood Week was an absolute nightmare. The way that I always describe it is, I'm like, it was hell in a handbasket, and I wouldn't trade it for anything, but I also wouldn't do it ever again.
Okay.
So the first thing is, so they fly you out there and everything like that. They get you settled in the hotel, and you normally have about 24 hours to, you know, get your bearings and everything like that before you meet up. Now, in the meantime, since you got the golden ticket from the judges and flown out to Hollywood, you've probably had a couple of months to prepare what you want your first solo audition to be. And that's what that first round is.
Right.
And it's structured similarly to the auditions that are that were in like the stadiums and stuff, where they line you up in different rows. And then you just, like, I think they're like rows of 10 people, and each person steps forward, sings their bit, and then steps back. And then the judges just deliberate at that point to tell you whether you're going on to the next round or not. The first year that I did it was the year that Ellen DeGeneres was on.
Okay.
And so, like, the first day of filming for round one, like, we all actually got to, like, dance with Ellen. So that was, like, that's, like, something that I'll, like, treasure for the rest of my life. It was amazing. But she was definitely the Paula Abdul, and I understand why she only, you know, stayed around for one season. Just having to, like, break people's hearts like that is 100%, you know, insanely difficult. But so the first year, I was not happy with my solo round audition. Like, it was awful. I was so unbelievably nervous, and I know that I didn't do well at all. Like, my voice cracked on a few things, and I still got through. And so you go straight from that. And I mean, you've performed, so you understand when you get done with either an audition or a performance, all you want to do is crash. Your body is so tired from all the adrenaline and the anxiety. Like, your body's just beyond exhausted. Well, you don't get to rest. And that's the hard part, is you actually go straight from round one, if you make it through, to group night. And group night is the night on American Idol where there's all this drama, and, you know, because essentially you're running on zero sleep. You have 24 hours to learn the lyrics, harmonies, and choreography for a completely new song with 3 to 4 strangers that you've never worked with before.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Huh. And the first year that I did it, my group was the group that was on TV all the time because of all the drama that was there. And I don't function well with that stuff. Like, it's just, it grates against my personality. I try to keep that kind of drama out of my life. So it was really, really hard for me that year. And that was the night that I got cut.
What kind of drama was going on? Like, what was happening?
We had this girl, her name is Mary, and she was just unbelievably hard-headed. Like, and I was getting messages for like a year later that was like, I just rewatched that episode and I want to punch that Mary girl in the face. She was rude. She didn't want to listen to anybody else. Nobody was right but her. Like, it was just one of those things where she immediately appointed herself leader and nobody else had a say in it whatsoever. And no matter how we all, like, we learned, if everybody learns differently, you know, how they structure different, it didn't matter. Like, everything was her way or the highway, period. And so only one person from our group, or no, two people from our group got through, and three of us got cut. And of course, all she did was sit there and blame everybody else. And that was the reason why she got cut. Whereas when you do group night, you are graded on how you perform individually as well as in a group.
Okay.
And I know that, like, I didn't shine in those moments, and I didn't, and it was part of it was I didn't want to, like, I've never wanted to be the star. So being in a group, I was like, I'm perfectly happy just chilling in the background, y'all. Like, I'm not here to steal your spotlight. You have fun. Like, yeah. That's your solo.
Singing
that's just who
in
I
the
am.
Background. Yeah. That was that, like, from
Martin. Exactly. Well, and my and
yeah.
And it's like, that was something that I really did take away from that year. Is I was just like, you know, I may not have, you know, quote unquote star quality. I was just like, but this is still something that I just absolutely love to do. And so the next year I decided to do it on my own. And I decided that I wasn't going to, my dad is also a singer. Okay. And so I decided that I wasn't going to ask my dad for help. Like, I still told him that I was going to do it, but I wanted to do it 100% on my own. Because I wanted to know that if I got cut or didn't make it through anything, I was like, that it was by, like, my own hand and nobody else's. Because my dad helped me with the arrangement and everything like that of my songs for the previous season.
Okay.
But the second year, I was like, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this on my own. And so went through the same rigmarole, same long audition process. And it was cool because actually a lot of the people remembered me the next year.
Cool.
And the executive producers for that show are unbelievably funny. They're these, like, hilarious two older British men, and they're just so nice. And the second year was the year Steven Tyler and Jennifer Lopez were there.
Okay.
And she's beautiful. Like, she's a unicorn. I'm convinced.
I can believe it. A lot of people, I don't know.
She's so majestic.
I don't know what it is with people and revisionist history, but Jennifer Lopez is... I feel like she's an icon.
Mm-hmm.
But
I'll fight somebody that argues that.
Yeah, she and people try to, like, shit on her acting. One thing, like, Selena's one thing, and then Out of Sight to me probably my favorite Jennifer Lopez movie. But if you're talking rom coms, The Wedding Planner's up there.
Yeah, I mean, you've got, like, Made in Manhattan and The Wedding Planner, and it's like, I wouldn't say that she, I mean, there are way worse actors out there. Like, let's be honest. There are way worse people out there.
I just didn't like how, what they were doing with her as far as her being Puerto Rican, trying to make her Italian or trying to, like, strip away her ethnicity. I wasn't too cool with that. But
or she's just like, she's Mexican, yeah.
Yeah, but other than that, like, other than that, it's fine. So you went through it the first, was Simon on both of those seasons that you did?
Yes. Okay. Actually, Simon and I really got along. Simon and I are very similar in personality. Who they show on TV, I mean, we all know, who they show on TV is not who somebody actually is.
Right.
Now, I'm not saying that he's, like, the biggest cuddly teddy bear, but he and I actually got along really well.
Now, what, so this time, this the second time around, what was your song choice getting through the first few rounds of the audition process?
Glitter in the Air by Pink.
Okay, I don't think I know that one.
Yeah, it's one of her ballads. I absolutely love that song. Okay. I still listen to the song to the day.
So Glitter in the Air.
Yeah, it's a slower ballad.
So how did the second year work out for you?
Amazing. Like, I had every audition that I had, I was super happy with. So, like, I had worked with my vocal coach, and I'd done all this prep work, and, like, even my dad was shocked because he's heard me sing in church and stuff like that in the shower, but, like, even he was like, oh my gosh, he's like, you did so well at, like, preparing that all on your own. Mm-hmm. So I went through all four of those auditions, and, like, the executive producers were like, you know, you sound way stronger this year than you did last year, you know, we're going to push you through the next round. So when we get to the next round, and Jennifer Lopez and Steven Tyler are there, and it is Randy and Simon are the other two. Mm-hmm. Now, the previous year, Randy was the only no that I got. So Randy, whenever I did the first set of auditions, I got three yeses, and Randy didn't say no, but he was a maybe. He was like, honestly, he goes, I just don't, he's like, I'm just not really feeling it from you. He was like, I just don't know if you have what it takes. And so the second year, I got all four yeses. So I was super excited and proud of myself for that. And my dad, of course, was like, okay, like, what do you want to sing for Hollywood Week? And I was like, nope, you're not helping me. I'm doing this again. So I started all over because you have to choose a completely different song whenever you come back.
Gotcha. And so that was, that Glitter in the Air by Pink took you through Hollywood Week too?
No, so Glitter in the Air by Pink was what got me to, like, through the celebrity judges.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then my first solo audition in Hollywood Week was, like, probably one of the best I've ever sang. I sang Syrup and Honey by Duffy.
Okay.
And I remember being so happy with my audition because I stepped forward, sang, and then stepped back. And I looked up. And because when you're done, like, you know, you step back and you like set your head down or whatever. And so I look up and Steven Tyler is just like leaning forward on his hands, smiling like a teenager.
Wow.
And he's just like staring at me. And I'm like, I sit there and all of a sudden I can feel like all the heat up, like coming up my neck, and I start blushing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had the microphone in my hand. And so when I looked back up and I was blushing, Steven Tyler winked at me. And I like immediately like leaned into myself and I started like giggling, but then I snorted and I snorted into the microphone and oh my gosh, it made everything 10 times worse. Like I practically threw that microphone at the next person. Like I could have died in that moment.
But that's an honest moment. I mean, Liv Tyler's dad is gushing over you. I mean, what are you going to do? You know,
die happy.
yeah that's awesome. So that's singing to me is one of the hardest things to do as an artist, like performing in the performing arts. To me, it's one, because it's so raw and so naked and you can't hide. Like there's no
way. It's pure vulnerability.
Yeah, it's just so vulnerable. It's really hard. Like I would get through songs doing musical theater and stuff in junior high and high school, and I was fine at doing it and doing the songs in undergrad and stuff. But it wasn't until I went to conservatory and watched these people in musical theater just do just this incredible work. Like, that's when I realized, oh, you have to actually act the song too. You know, like it was so, and these young people, they were like my age, but like they were, you know, I was in grad school. So a lot of these kids were like 18 and 19, and just to see the performance, and it's just an incredible work. And it's so, I don't know that they get that get enough respect from like even being in the chorus of a Broadway show. Like the mastery you have to have over your instrument is it's nothing like it. I mean, so I'm always impressed by singers. That's like one of my favorite thing to do, really, is to watch, to go to a concert and watch people sing and to see live theater. Because I wouldn't consider myself to be a big musical guy.
I love musicals, mm-hmm. but like I have to be engaged by the story to love a musical.
Exactly.
Like I can think that the music's catchy. I was like, but you have to have a good story, or else I'm just gonna be like, okay, I could just like listen to this at home. Like this is just like a CD.
Yeah,
and I can skip to the songs that I like.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I just seeing some of my friend, one of my good friends that I've mentioned him on the show before, Scott Stanglin, who's a Broadway actor, and we went to grad school together, and to just see him. He was in Once the Musical, and he was basically kind of like a chorus, and he had some scenes and stuff, but just the stuff that the demands, the physical and vocal demands that they had to endure over a course of about 2 hours was just incredible, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then seeing him, he understudied for Josh Groban in Natasha and Pierre in The Great Comet. And he went on.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to see that show.
It's a good show. And I saw him go on as Pierre, and I got emotional watching him. I've told the story hundreds of times on the show, but it's apropos to our conversation. But it was just like, it's amazing. And just watching all these people, like it is, it is a magical thing that's happening in front of you, like when you see these live performances. But getting back to you, so you're doing this, and how far did you go on your second time around?
Same to Hollywood Week, but this year, thankfully, no drama. Uh-huh. I don't want to be in the spotlight, and I think that group night is the night that defines those people that do, mm-hmm. defines the people that want to, you know, express themselves in every way that they can in a song. And every, you know, there are those people that do like 70,000, you know, key and note changes, and they show their entire vocal range on one note, and you don't even know how they did it. And it's yeah. it's one of those things where you're like, okay, maybe, you know, too much creativity there, but it's like I had a decent group. We were given kind of a crummy song to do as a group. We were given Carry On My Wayward Son.
What is that? I don't think I know that. Who sings
you
that?
What? Sorry, you're
Carry On My Wayward.
I should actually know that.
Who
yeah.
sings that? Let me look it up. I can look it up.
I know it. Kansas sings it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know that one.
It's one of those songs where it's like, if you hear the beginning of it, you're probably going to be like, oh yeah, I know this song. It's like, it's one of those, it's like a bar background song. Like, that's the best way to describe it. It's not one that you like go, you sit in your car and you're like, you know what I want to listen to? Carry On My Wayward Son. Like, gotcha. It's one of those songs where it's like, it comes on in the background at a bar.
Yeah. And so after that, so,
I mean, we had good harmonies and everything like that. But that year, that one kind of broke me, because that was the year that I actually really wanted to do it. I wasn't doing it for my dad or anybody else. Like, it was the year that I chose to do it for me. Mm-hmm. And getting, you know, cut at the same point, like, I really haven't sang publicly since. And unfortunately, my vocal cords have atrophied. And it would take me some time of repeatedly doing this to get back into it. But I do miss it a lot. And every time I go see a musical, I'm always like, I miss them so much.
Well, that sucks. That sucks to hear. Like, so when your vocal cords atrophy, what does that mean? Like that, like you, is that
your vocal cords are a muscle, just like anything else. Yeah. So if you don't use, you know, the vocal cords that you use for singing versus talking, eventually, like you, I don't want to say that you ever lose it. It's just you don't have the same kind of control, or you're probably not, like, your range gets smaller, so you're not able to hit all the same notes right away. Mm-hmm. I know for a fact that, like, my breath control isn't the same as it was before.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where I bet that I could get back to where I was, or I could even get close to it. It just would take a lot of work, and it takes a lot of structured work working with other people that are, like, aurally inclined so that they can hear what you're singing and adjust and help you, you know, figure that out. But mm-hmm. that unfortunately also means a lot of expenses that go with that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That sucks that that did that to you. Like, I mean, I don't know how much I've talked about it on the show. Like, my first big attempt to really get into show business was about, maybe I was like 16. I don't know. You might be too young to remember this, but there's a show on BET called Teen Summit. And, it was a show where they had, like a group of teenagers, and they would talk about like issues going on in current mm-hmm. day USA. And they were like cool kids, and they had a host. And it was when BET, their offices were in Washington, D.C. I'm from the Maryland, D.C. area. And it was really cool. There was one dude on the show who went to my high school. He was 2 years older than me. This guy named Joe Webb, and he was a super talented tap dancer. He was in Bringing the Noise, Bringing the Funk with Savion Glover, and super talented guy. And I was like, wow, this guy's really cool, and he's on Teen Summit. I want to be on Teen Summit. And then I auditioned in between, I think it was my sophomore, the summer before my sophomore year. And I auditioned, I did really well, and I didn't get it, and I was crushed. That was like the biggest, like, heartbreak ever. Because before then, I figured out like early on that I wasn't going to be an athlete, because like I could have been decent at football, but I didn't like it as much. My dad wanted it more than I did. And, mm-hmm. and, uh, And I just remember auditioning for Teen Summit and I was crushed. I didn't get it. And that's when I realized, like, okay, all right, in show business, if I want to keep doing this, I'm not going to get everything, even though there's, you'll have that disappointment. And I auditioned one more time, didn't get it. And I was like, oh, well, all right, well, I can't, this isn't for me. But I just remember that just being crushed. And then there was other kids that got it after then from my school that got it. And I was just like, ah, yeah, show business.
Yeah, and it's a cruel mistress more than anything else. But it's like, if I actually had to choose, I would love to be a backup singer for the rest of my life. You don't have to be in the spotlight. You still get to sing, go on tours. You get to work in studios. I love working in studios. I think it's so much fun.
They kill it, too. Like, I mean, it's good money, too. What was that?
Mm-hmm. Well, you can, yeah.
What was that? There was a documentary about background singers. 20 feet from stardom. What is it called?
It's no, I think it's 6 feet from stardom.
6 feet from stardom. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I actually have that listed in my notes.
Okay. Let's see.
Like of things that I need to watch.
20 feet from stardom, 2013. Yes. Backup singers live in a world of blah, 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 blah. Yeah. It's really good. It's worth seeing. Like Luther Vandross was a background singer for
Okay, so really funny story. Okay. My aunt was Luther Vandross's backup singer, and like they were best friends for like most of his life.
Really? Did you ever get to meet him?
Yeah.
Wow.
I did not, but like a lot of my family has met him.
Oh, okay. So you didn't get to meet him. But so mm-hmm. I guess he was a real cool guy then. If your family liked him and everything, past his singing.
Yeah, I mean he's. All the stories that I've heard, like he's a very, very nice man. And like my aunt was very, very fond of him. And I remember whenever he passed away, I was the first one that found out and I called her and she was like devastated.
Mm. Yeah, that's.
She's like my favorite auntie though. I completely forgot about this. She actually came to all of my auditions in Dallas okay. for Idol.
Yeah.
So she was my vocal coach that I worked with my first year.
So where did this singing start for you? I kind of wish you would, I don't know, now that part, maybe it's because I'm a performer and stuff too. I kind of don't want to see the fire extinguish in people when they clearly have some talent. I've never heard you sing before, but I know just listening to you talk about it, you could tell there's like a love for it, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, I bet you could probably still do something, Aaron. So where did this start for you? Where did you grow up? Where did you grow up? What does your mom and dad do?
So I've been singing most of my life. I started singing in our Seventh-day Adventist church in Westminster, California. I was born and raised in Southern California.
Okay.
I lived there until I was 16. And then my dad got a job in Texas. And so my dad, stepmom, my baby sister, and I moved with him whenever he transferred over. So I lived in Texas for my last 2 years of high school.
Okay.
What kind of work? And then after I graduated.
What kind of work did your dad do? Does he do?
My dad works in disaster recovery. So my dad works for large technological firms. Teaching them what to do when things go wrong, essentially, like if servers go down or if like now he works for Microsoft. And so he has to deal with events around the world. So like when there was like massive flooding in India, he had to work with their call centers and their offices there. Mm-hmm. Ireland has a big Microsoft presence, too. So he essentially like for here local in Washington, he builds all the plans that are like, if the server goes out or if, you know, Mount Rainier blows up, here's what we do mm-hmm. for all of like Microsoft headquarters offices and stuff like that. And my mom's a medical biller.
Okay.
So right now she's up here in Washington. She works for a hospital up here.
Is your dad in Seattle too? And Microsoft?
Yeah. So, okay. After I graduated in Texas, I went to college in Oklahoma, because it was like far enough away to be independent, but close enough to come home whenever I wanted. It was like 2.5 hours. It wasn't bad at all.
I did the same thing. I want my freedom.
Yeah.
Can you wash my clothes?
Exactly. Yeah. But I was like, but also I need to do laundry.
Exactly.
When we moved to Texas, almost all of my family stayed in Southern California. So that's where the bulk of them still are to this day. Like my aunts, uncles, cousins, everybody's still there.
Was there a culture shock moving from Southern California to Texas?
You know, everybody always asks me that, and it really isn't that bad.
Not that bad.
I would definitely think that it says, like, it depends 100% where you live in Texas. Where we lived was in Fort Worth, so... It was, you know, well, like the city we lived in was ranked like number 7 nicest city to live in America.
Oh,
like,
wow.
Okay. It really depends on where you end up moving in Texas. I would say, like, if you moved to like a city like Abilene, yeah, that was probably going to be a culture shock from Southern California, just because it's all like dirt and horses, and I'm terrified of horses. But
why are you like, terrified of horses?
They have such big teeth. Oh my gosh, I'm so afraid of their teeth. I'm so afraid of being bitten by a horse.
I'm not judging.
And it's a completely irrational fear. I have not had a bad experience with a horse ever, but they're big and they terrify me.
Did you ever ride horses at all?
Nope.
I sat on
one once to try to conquer my fear. I sat on one.
Is that on Instagram or something?
Yeah, I think from like years ago.
Okay, maybe that's why I saw it or so. I don't know. But for some reason, I picture you in a horse helmet. Not a horse helmet. What do you call it? Like, okay, never mind. Never mind me. what is Seattle like? Because when I think
Are you talking about like maybe if you saw one recently, it might have been a picture of me with a cow.
I don't know. See, now I'm going to have to look that up and then act.
Because when I was in Scotland, I love bovine creatures, and I was obsessed with Highland cows. So when I went to Scotland, that was like the first thing that I was excited to see.
Okay.
And I wanted to smuggle one home because they're so cute and fluffy.
All right. What did you study in college? Is it Oklahoma? What's this?
Mm-hmm, yeah, I went to Oklahoma City University, and I got my degree in English and theater performance.
Okay. Did you do theater in school?
Yeah, did a couple of plays, and then I, whenever my senior year was, I got one of the leading roles in a play. That was a lot of fun.
Which show?
And, like, it was, I have it listed. My memory is absolutely terrible. I have it listed somewhere, but it was we jokingly called it the Black Show because every single member of our cast is a minority and primarily African American.
Okay.
No, it was kind of fun. And our director was Native American. We all just had an absolute blast doing it. But after Idol, like I said, you know, being on the stage was just a completely different experience for me. Like
So you did perform You did do. You did perform.
I didn't. Like, I had such anxiety performing after that I actually tried to quit the show on 2 different occasions, and she wouldn't let me. And I'm thankful that she wouldn't let me.
Mm-hmm.
But just being on stage and being judged is, like, just crippling to me.
Mm.
And so, like, I don't know. It's just it completely changed my mindset when it came to performing after I did it. And I kind of hate it for doing that, if that makes sense. But I know that it's in my own head, so I technically am hating myself for that. So it's weird.
No, it's not. I mean, it's... Performing is kind of a, like... It's kind of a weird thing when you think about it.
It is.
It's like I, as much as I love doing it, but it's just... Because I kind of feel like in a way that I'm an introverted extrovert. Where it's like,
I'm an ambivert 100%.
Yeah. Like is that what it's called? Okay. That's a smart person.
Well, it's like I'm primarily introverted unless the situation specifically calls for extroversion.
There you go. Yeah.
Then I can turn it on, But then I'm exhausted when I'm done. Like, I used to work at Apple, and when I worked at Apple, every single day I would come home and I would just want to crash on the couch because I had to be all happy and bubbly and chatty and talkative all day. And then coming home, I'm just like, I am beyond white.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I totally understand. I mean, going to conservatory is like, there's some people that are always on, like when you go out, you're just going out, grab drinks or grab dinner or something, and people are just like, ah, and it's just like.
And that almost is exhausting hanging out with them too.
It is. It's like, dude, just chill, calm down.
Yeah, like, it's okay. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah,
it almost gets to the point where you feel like they're faking it, even if it is just 100% their personality. You're like, how can somebody have this much energy all the time?
Yeah. Yeah, it's totally. And a lot of like the comedians that I hang out with, they seem to be a little more tame, like just a little more chill, because like you can just go out and chill and have a good time. It is a weird thing, like to get up in front of people to sing or dance. But like, I think at the same time, there has to be like a need to want to be there. I remember doing a play that I had a lot of anxiety about. I was like, it was maybe like, shoot, like maybe like 10 or 12 years ago, I was doing this play in Chicago that was really emotionally draining. And like, I didn't want to do it, but I wanted to, you know, like I just felt like really compelled to be there. There was a reason that I wanted to be there, but it was just, it was pretty stressful.
It was exhausting.
Yeah, yeah. And once I was on stage, I was fine. But like, I felt like I had to be there. It's just it's an odd thing. Like I was on set like yesterday, and I was just like, "Yeah, this is my dream here." it's like I'm doing it.
And you're like, "This is it."
Yeah, this is it. And my dad, he told me, I've said this on the show before, but like my dad said, "Oh, I bet this thing isn't what you thought it would be." And I was like, "Yeah, because I like it even more. I like it a lot more."
You're like, "Joke's on you."
Joke's on you, Dad. But he's always like, my parents have always been super supportive. I'm thankful for that. Like they've held me up like a lot, and it's not easy. And it's like you do have to, there's sacrifices that you have to make, and there's things that you, it's a thing. It's, I don't know. Like in a lot of ways, I look at you as being smart for not,
but like I said, sometimes like, I feel like a piece of me is missing sometimes.
Yeah. I think at the same time, like, that's kind of why I'm kind of like saying, well, you probably should do something about that. But I cannot, just being the person that just appreciates it. And I'm sure there's a lot of talent in you. I was like, well, I think you should probably be doing it. Because when I saw that, I was like, oh, I never heard that. Because I know that like I found out about you through John. And Tim, John from About to Review, and Tim, People's Critic. Yeah, and just like listening to you on the podcast and you guys talking about musicals and stuff. And I was like, huh, all right. And then like I seeing this Facebook picture of you, I was like, oh, we got to talk about that. But I think at the same time, like even I think dreams change. As you get older.
Yeah, definitely.
You get older, and I've noticed, like, I talk about it in my stand-up, where it's just like, you think when you're young, you think about, like, I'm going to take over the world, and I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
And it doesn't happen the way that you thought it would, and your dreams kind of get narrowed down. And it's like, I think that's a part of growing up, it's a part of adulthood, and, like, how do you manage that? And how do you, like, I'm going through the period now where it's like, oh, things that I've worked towards are kind of happening, and it's not happening in the way that I thought it would, but it's still, I think at an older age,
still happening.
It's still really cool. And it's like, oh, now this is causing a disturbance in the everyday life. And it's a good one nonetheless, but it's sort of like, well,
how? But it's a shift, yeah.
Yeah, it's a shift, because I was talking to one of the principal actors on the show, and he was saying, yeah, you know, it's good that you have, like, you have a day job and you do your comedy and you're acting, because you never want to go into, he said, you never want to go into an audition saying, I need this. Because they can.
Yeah, it's like going into a casino. You never want to go into a casino if it's like what you need to make money.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel that I need this when I walk into my day job. But it's definitely a thing where it's like, oh, this would be awesome. Like, you know, the audition I was telling you about before we started, like, that would be amazing. But it's like, I would love to get it, but if it doesn't happen, it's not the end of the world. Cause like,
yeah,
right now
it's an appreciation versus like a need, because the need, I think, takes the actual drive and the passion out of it. If you're like, I have to have this.
Yes. Yeah. Cause I remember a year or two ago, I think it was like maybe 2 years ago, I bombed this, Law and Order SVU audition. And it was like a meltdown. It wasn't a full on meltdown, but I was auditioning to play a lab tech, and mm-hmm. and it was just like the suspect had blood residue on this table and blah blah blah, and I just kept messing it up. But then I did get it, but the casting director was like, "No, you got it. It's fine." It's like, "No, let me just do it one more time."
And he's like, no, no, really, I promise.
Yeah, he's like, no, you got it, you got it. And it was just like, and they've never called me back.
Oh.
So it's like, it's just one of those things where it's like, you can't, it's I take it seriously, but it's not the end of the world. Like, I don't know. It's just, it's one of those things. Like, nobody's perfect. And,
yeah,
we all bomb. It happens, but
our life.
Yeah, such is life. Where else do I want to go with this before we talk about the movies? No. So how did you get into, well, for what else? Oh. So how did you get into writing and like film criticism and all that stuff? Are you still doing it? Because you kind of. You stopped after Ferdinand.
It's been a little strange. So Tim and I are trying to figure out a way. It's hard to explain. Sorry. So previously, what was happening is my mentor Jose has a PR firm, and that's what is accredited for getting the screeners.
Okay.
And because of he went through some job changes where he took a role with Fox and things got really busy with him. So he wasn't able to keep up with the emails and things like that as often. Mm-hmm. So for the most part, Tim has really been stepping up and trying to let me know when we do have screeners that he thinks that I might want to go to and stuff like that. But for several months, it was one of those things where like Jose was so busy that I didn't get the heads up on any screeners. And it was one of those things where like writing is something that I've always been passionate about. And as much as I love film, like whether or not I have access to film, I will always keep writing.
Yeah. Cause I like your,
and so,
oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh no, go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, I liked your writing. So I read a couple of the reviews. Like I like how like people like, I think like Roger Ebert and Anne Hornaday, like they kind of put themselves in the writing, like in the review, without like overtaking mm-hmm. the piece, but it's about the movie, but there's something that's like relatable. I just remember one time, like, well, your Detroit review, like you kind of talked about your dad and then how he must have felt, like, you know, I don't know. It was just good. And I like the writing is very personable, and it was nice. I guess that's how I
Thank
felt
you.
About it.
I appreciate
so,
that.
So it's like when, you know, it's like, oh, well, why did she stop? You know, so that's, so you're going to.
Yeah, no, I'm working on it. Yeah, no, we're just trying to find a way to get me accredited on my own so that I don't have to worry about going through a third party right now. So that's what we're currently trying to tackle. And I work four jobs, and so unfortunately, that means I'm busy a lot. So for me, the biggest hassle lately has been trying to find a like setting aside time to do my writing.
Sure.
Versus like knowing that I have the time to do it. So I've got like two reviews that I want to get out this weekend that I'm going to work on actually after I get off film with you. But the first thing I have to work on when I get off film with you is the backlog of Etsy orders that I have because I also run my own Etsy shop.
Yeah, so talk about the four jobs and then let's get into the Etsy stuff. Your Etsy.
So I have film critic stuff. My day job that pays all the bills so that I can afford to work four jobs, if that makes sense, is I'm a technical recruiter for a company called Extreme Consulting. So our company is companies like Amazon and Microsoft have roles that they need help filling, and so they call in our company to help them find viable candidates for those spots. So that's my main day job. Then I have my Etsy shop, which is called Flourish and Inkblots. And I started that a little over a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. That started at the hands of a bad breakup. So I needed something to keep my hands and my head busy. And so I started I made a few decals, and out of nowhere, like after I readjusted some of my advertising settings and things like that in 1 month, like it blew up the November of 2 years ago.
Okay.
And so that's been keeping me relatively busy since then, and it's definitely still keeping my hands and my head busy, that's for sure.
I wish I was like you after a breakup where you create art and not go to McDonald's. That's what
No, there were definitely some trips to McDonald's, trust me.
I did get a bit out of
I did get
some comedy out of it, but it still sucks. But yeah, that just is cool.
It's one of those things where I have, it's a gift and a curse, because I'm very much similar to my father in that, like, a lot of times when something is done to me, it's done. I can't, like, I told myself after this happened, because this was a person that I was actually supposed to marry. So it wasn't somebody that, like, it wasn't just like a fling that happened. It was, you know, it was a 2-year relationship that ended in a lot of devastating terms.
Sure.
And so I gave myself 1 month, and then I told myself I wasn't going to wallow anymore. And that I was going to find some way to continue being a productive member of society, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I didn't do much else after I wallowed, but, I eventually just started to push myself to get through it. You know, I would take myself on hikes, or thankfully with Washington, we've got a plethora of outdoor activities that will always keep people busy.
Yes.
And, I definitely did gain weight. I definitely went to McDonald's probably way more than I should have. But, no, my Etsy shop, I think, was an amazing opportunity that I legitimately did not think I was going to make money with it. Like, it was purely for the purpose of just staying busy. And then all of a sudden it started blowing up.
That's good. So what is this like? Yeah. Like the decals, like you could put it on a shirt and stuff, or how does this
work? So they're not heat applied decals. So they're more like decals that you would put on like your car or like a coffee mug.
Sure.
Or like something along those lines. So they're not heat applied decals, though.
I like your nerd.
I've yet to branch into that.
I like your nerd alert section. Your Star Wars decal, Rogue One, When You Wish Upon a Death Star.
Oh yeah, the Disney themed one. That was a lot of fun. Yeah, I get there are a lot of I don't ever want to call something like a bestseller. But I get really happy when I know that, like, some of the...
Wait. Why wouldn't you call it a bestseller?
Well, I feel like the phrase bestseller, I don't know, it just sounds weird coming from, like, an Etsy shop. I know. I sell myself short in a lot of ways, and I know that it's... I'm working on it.
Believe in yourself. Believe in yourself. Don't...
But it's one of those things where, like, I get really happy knowing that there are other, like, super nerdy people out there that love a lot of the things that I do, because a lot of the designs that are on there are just things that I like. And, you know, I always get shocked when I'm like, oh my gosh, I've sold, you know, $300 worth of like Doctor Who stickers in the last 2 months or whatever. Like,
that's
it's
great.
It's people that love those little nerdy things just like I do that make what I do possible more than anything else.
Were you all, you sound like you were a theater nerd, so you're probably just a real big nerd when you were a kid.
I'm just a nerd really more than anything else. Like, no qualms about it. I grew up with my dad watching Star Trek, and I've always loved Star Wars, and nerdy things are awesome. Like, living life as a nerd is way cool.
How did you feel about the last Star Wars movie, The Last Jedi?
It was insanely predictable.
Did it ruin your childhood at all?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. Nothing could ruin that. Because I'm able to separate myself from things like that. It's like, you know, this is just a new addition to the series, but it doesn't take away the magic that the series had before.
Right.
It's like people that said that with Fantastic Beasts and Harry Potter. I'm like, yeah, I was like, it's just a new chapter. I was like, it doesn't take away from what you felt when you first watched it or what you grew up with. It's just maybe, you know, if you don't agree with what the director's style or choice was, then okay. You know, but that doesn't mean that it's like all is lost.
I agree with you 100%. So we got the Etsy, and that's cool. Flourish and ink blots. I'll post all of this in the show notes, but I just wanted to to highlight that, because it's really cool when people go out and do their own thing while doing their
thanks.
What does what did John call it? The muggle job? The
Oh, I assume it'd be muggle jobs, because yeah, that's kind of what it feels like. That's for sure.
Yeah, while you're slogging away at your day job to make money. I've heard someone on another actor say survival job. I've heard that before.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's always good.
9 to 5.
Yeah, and you have something to come home to when you're I think more people are doing that in these days and times. At least
they're saying that our generation is like the generation of side hustles. And part of me wants to be like, well, that's because like life is unaffordable if you don't have a side hustle. Like, I legitimately don't know if I could live in Seattle if I didn't work 3 to 4 jobs.
Now speak on
that. It's just insanely.
Speak on that a little bit. Cause I've talked to John and Tim. I think we kind of went a little in depth with it. But Seattle's like what? That's got to be like what? And is that in the top 5 major cities, like as far as size and all the other things?
Well, so I don't know about size, but as of right now, Seattle rivals New York City and San Francisco for cost of living.
See, that's what I was going for, because New York City, like I live in New Jersey, which is I live like 15 minutes away from the city when the traffic's not bad. And it's brutal. Like, just even just living in this area is expensive. And I don't know if you have roommates or not, but I don't have a roommate.
Yeah, I have to.
So it is no joke. I remember being in San Francisco, just working with Chris Hardwick out there. It's so expensive. It is.
And it's one of those things where it's like, unless you have a job working for Amazon or Microsoft, like you have roommates, you have two jobs, or you are still living with your parents. And it's like, if you went to college, great. So you have student loan bills that you have to pay on top of the cost of living for this city. And I don't know if you saw, I posted on Facebook, but like the average household, like the cost of living in Seattle, the average home price is like, as of a month ago, was like $737,000 for a house. And that's like the median cost of a home here. While over 60% of the people in Seattle make less than $60,000 a year. And since that study was published a month ago, it has since gone up $20,000 for the median home price.
It's crazy. Like, I looked at I got my taxes done last month, and I found out how much, like, everything that I made, and it just still felt like, I made the most money that I've ever made, like, with my day job and, like show business type stuff, and it still didn't feel like anything, you know?
Like anything, like you'd even made an impact.
Yeah, it's like, how did I do that? And it's just...
Or, like, you look at it and you're like, I made all this money, but where did it all go?
Where did it go? Yeah, It's crazy. Yeah, it, like, and so what is, like, do you have to have a car in Seattle, or do you take the train everywhere?
They do have really great public transit. I have a car just because I have a car for a lot of reasons. One, I can't actually imagine my life without a car. I've had a car for the bulk of it, and I like being self-assured in that, like, if I needed to get somewhere, I could. Yeah. And I don't want to pay like $40 for an Uber or whatever. But if you live and work in Seattle, the public transit opportunities that they have here are really good.
Okay.
They have bus systems. They've got like the Link Line, which is the transit that will take you to like the airport or south of Seattle and stuff like that.
Gotcha.
But they just have a lot of other things that most other cities don't have in excess like they do here. And in Seattle, they also, you know, they care a lot about their carbon footprint and things like that. And it's one of those things where a lot of people complain about public transit here. And I feel like those are people that have not really experienced what the rest of the country has to deal with when it comes to public transit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I went to the UK, earlier this year, and I have so many friends that live in New York and that have to deal with the absolute BS of the MTA.
Yes.
And after going to London, where I'm like, okay, so the transit system in London is significantly older than the transit system in New York and is 10 times better. So what the heck is up? And for the most part, it sounds like it comes down to the fact that in London, like, the transit system's shut down. So they actually have like off and down times, whereas in New York, it's constantly running 24/7.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of factors. They're always renovating. They're always doing something. But it just seems like the prices for your train ticket, subway tickets and whatnot, they keep going up, but the service doesn't. Like, the service just kind of...
Yeah, it was like, but you guys aren't getting any more reliable
right
service.
And so it's like, sometimes I feel like when I come in for shows and auditions, it's better for me to just park near, well, usually like doing stand up at night, like after 8 o'clock, like you can find street parking. It might be a hassle in some locations, but for the most part, you can find parking. But when I'm going on auditions and stuff, yeah, I just have to like suck it up and pay $20 to park for an hour or so. And,
yeah.
And deal with it, because like taking the train is just like, God, this is brutal. Like,
I looked into moving to New York a few times, and everybody was like, you know, like if you move, like you won't bring your car because you'll be paying like $600 a month just to store it someplace. And I'm like, that's ridiculous.
Well, if you lived in Queens, like, even Astoria is getting crazy now, but. If you lived on like,
yeah, I've got a few friends in Astoria.
Yeah, a lot of my comedian friends, they live in Astoria, they live in Brooklyn, and then some of them live like where I live is pretty much the suburbs. It's really a suburb of New York, and you're just like you're just kind of on the outskirts. And what I like about it is like, I mean, in my youth, I lived in Chicago. When I was in grad school and stuff, and it was fun to live in a city. I'm like, yay, I'm in my 20s and I'm living in the city. It's really cool. But then it's also fun where you can just like, where I live, it's quiet. There's parking for the most part. Like I get mad now. I don't know if it's people that actually live in my apartment complex that are parking and taking up the spaces. I don't know if it's more people occupying the buildings here. But that's kind of become a pain when I come home. Like, anyway.
Well, yeah. And you're like, I worked hard to like have this parking space. Like, get out.
Yeah. Like, what are you guys doing? But anyway, like, it's nice because, like, I feel like it's fun to go into the city, live my dream, do comedy, act and stuff, and go see plays.
And then step away.
And then step away and come home where it's a little more serene. And it's just serene. And it's a lot
quieter. You can decompress.
Yeah, yeah. Like, that's important, too. I mean, but I think that's me just getting older. But at the same time, you know, it's not bad. But
I was like, I don't know. That sounds pretty nice to me. So
yeah. So, I mean, if you do decide, I mean, you know, just think about that. But I don't know. Well, you know, I did, before we talk about A Wrinkle in Time, I did want to, Tim and I were talking about this. He said that you saw Annihilation, right?
Yeah.
And did you read the first book?
Yeah.
What did you think about that movie? And then the book as it compares to the book and all that stuff.
So I thought with the movie more than anything else, so I was not a fan of the book.
Okay.
I wanted to like the book a lot. And I think that the concept of the book was there. I personally just didn't care for the author's style of writing.
Okay.
And it's because it's primarily narrative based, which is a very hard thing to sell for someone like myself, because I'm like, I don't want to be inside this person's head the entire time I'm reading this book. It's just not my favorite style of writing.
Gotcha.
And so like, with the movie though, as far as I could tell, that movie was a very, very loose adaptation of that book.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, the whole controversy around World War Z, where it was the book, but it really wasn't, like, it just kept the title and everything like that.
Okay. I don't really remember.
That's what I kind of felt about this movie, is that I felt like it kept the bones, like the original bones of what was supposed to happen in that book.
Yeah.
But the actual outcome and things like that, it was nothing like the book. Because, and like, it would have been very difficult for them to make an entire narrated story out of it. So I get why they changed, like, point of view. Yeah. But the actual events of that movie, like, half of that stuff didn't happen in the book.
Yeah, I did not read the book, but I was interested in getting your interpretation. Did you like the movie? Did you like the film?
I honestly feel like I'm still processing it, because there was a lot of stimulus in that movie.
Yeah.
I thought it was shot beautifully. I thought the cinematography was gorgeous. The special effects were great. And I thought that I loved seeing, like, a lot of the actresses that are there are actresses that I've enjoyed watching in the past. I'm a huge Natalie Portman fan.
Yeah.
But I would not say that it was one of my favorite movies. I wouldn't say that it was an awful movie by any means, but I would just say that it's not going to be for everyone.
Wait a minute. Is this going to be like another Columbus for you?
Okay. I already told you with Columbus, I thought that my commentary was not as well represented as what I actually thought. I thought the movie was shot absolutely beautifully. You're never going to let me live this down.
I just had to give you shit. It's totally fine. It's totally fine. No, well, you know,
I thought, like,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's one of those things. I hate you. Tell me. It's one of those things where it's like, I think that with Columbus specifically, like, that movie, I feel caters to somebody that wants a little bit more of a slower paced indie style movie.
A nerd.
This
like me,
movie, yeah. I feel like is not, no, I don't think it has anything to do with nerdiness though.
No, go ahead. You're right.
I just feel like Annihilation it's not even going to be a movie that I feel like every person that loves science fiction is going to love. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think it's going to be for everybody.
Yeah, you know what's interesting to me, like, I think, like, when it comes to, like, an indie movie nerd like me, like, I would say my expectations were kind of high because I'm a Haley Lou Richardson fan, and I like her, and then when I saw the movie, like, because, I don't know, I feel like you, Tim, and John, because you're film critics, you get the access to the movies, you get it beforehand, and you guys have perks and stuff. And I think sometimes for me, it's like there's the things that I have to do to get to that movie because I kind of live. Mm-hmm. I live in the city. I live really close to the city, but it's kind of a hassle. Yeah, it's kind of a hassle. And so I remember going to see Columbus. I was super excited. I got my ticket online at the IFC Center, and I made the journey to go see it. And then when I saw it,
I trekked many long miles.
Yes. And it was sort of like, oh, this really fit the bill. And like it exceeded my expectations in a lot of ways. So I really dug it.
I also think that I didn't know what to expect because John didn't tell me what the movie was about.
Yeah. I tried to get one.
Like, I had no idea what I was going to watch going into it, and I hadn't seen a movie like that before.
Yeah. It was sort of like that, the whole Before Sunrise, the Richard Linklater series. It kind of had that vibe.
Mm-hmm.
And, I really liked it. And it, the more that I think about the Oscars and when we talk about diversity, I mean, I'm thinking like, damn, well, you know, could John Cho have been considered to be like best supporting actor? Or like,
I mean, 100%. I thought he did a brilliant job in that movie.
You know what I mean? Like, he's a leading man. Good look. At least, I mean, and I'm being like, you know, like, could he have been in that best supporting actor, best actress, best actor category? I liked Haley Lou Richardson's performance. I liked the cinematography. I liked, Koganada. I was thinking, could that have been considered? But it's like a small company producing it. But anyway, back to Annihilation. Like, when we were talking about, like, it's definitely not for everybody. But I would say for me, if Black Panther didn't come out before, like, I was really excited about Annihilation because
I wanted it to be amazing.
Yeah, I loved Ex Machina a lot, and I really loved that movie. How did you feel about that one?
I haven't seen that one actually.
Really, Aaron, this is over.
I know.
Do you have Amazon Prime?
Should I just hang up now?
No, don't hang up. Do you have Amazon Prime?
I do.
It's on there. So if you ever, whenever you want, it's a Prime movie. But it was like, I really liked Alex Garland's work. And what was interesting about that, when that movie came out, that's like, to me, look, just aesthetically from the way it was promoted, just like seeing the trailers, like, oh, this is okay. I'm excited about this. I want to see it. But then they were putting that movie out. They were promoting it during the NBA playoffs. And I'm like, this doesn't seem like the type of movie, but they were putting they were putting a lot behind it, and it did well, and a lot of people liked it. But I was like, I was thinking like, oh, this is like a movie for me, not mainstream America, and it did do well. So the hype for me was for Annihilation was just like off the charts, and then of course, you have a juggernaut like Black Panther, but right that week, February 23rd, like the week after Black Panther, I was in the theater to see that one, and I just got Movie Pass, and I'd seen it and I liked it, and it's still with me, and I ended up
Black Panther or Annihilation.
Well, both are still, but Annihilation is still with me, like you said. And I was trying to kill time before meeting up with a friend about a week ago. And I said, well, I'm not going to eat anything right now. I'm going to just wait to meet my friend. I said, I'll just go see Annihilation until it's time. I'll use my movie pass and watch Annihilation again. And I think there's so much there. Like, I think it's a lot there, and it made me like the movie.
And I told Tim, I was like, I feel like I need to see it again.
Yeah. Yeah. And because it felt like, because when Tim and I talked about it, when he was on, the thing that did it for me was just like, okay, there's these broken people and they're going into the shimmer because really they don't have anything else to lose and they're trying to find something. So why not? Why not just go into the shimmer and try to figure stuff out? But yeah, I think there's a lot to it. And I dug it, but I just wanted to get your take on it because you had read the novel.
I think that I expected something different because it wasn't like the novel. Mm-hmm. Like I think that was the hard part for me, is that I went in with those expectations because I had read the book.
Yeah.
And it was not the same.
Yeah. A lot of people were pissed. It's not like the book. And in interviews, he said, yeah, I read the book and it was kind of like a memory of the book, but just like like a loose interpretation of it.
Very loose.
Okay, well, I want to shift gears now, Aaron. I want to talk I want to talk about A Wrinkle in Time with you. I guess usually when I review a movie, I read the horrible, sometimes decent Google blurb about it on the Google page. Mm-hmm. Like when you just Google A Wrinkle in Time movie and I read what comes up. So I guess I'll do that and then just have you just kind of take it away after that. I'll do it. All right. Let's see. I mess up a lot, so don't laugh or laugh at me when I mess up. It's fine.
I haven't recorded with them in a while, but whenever Tim, John, and I record, we make John leave all of his mess ups in the podcast because we're like, we love when you laugh at yourself more than anything else.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm reading out loud for me. All right, here we go. I think just before I get into that, I just think sometimes the commas are misplaced and the sentences are like run on.
Oh yeah, like where you think you should pause is not where you should pause.
Yeah, and I should be a lot better at this. All right, here we go. A Wrinkle in Time. Meg Murray and her little brother Charles Wallace have been without their scientist father, Mr. Murray, for 5 years. I thought it was four. Ever since he discovered a new planet and used the concept known as a tesseract to travel there. Joined by Meg's classmate Calvin O'Keefe and guided by the three mysterious three mysterious astral travelers known as Mrs. What's It, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Which, the children have a dangerous journey to a planet that possesses all of the evil in the universe. This movie is
Bravo.
I got through it, kind of. This movie was directed by Ava DuVernay, who did Selma and The 13 and a lot of other indie movies. And they don't tell me who wrote this off the bat, and I hate when they do that. So I'm
who wrote the book?
No, well, yeah. Who wrote the book? It was what is it?
Madeline Langle.
Langles. That's how you say it. In 1962. And who did the script for this? The screenplay was by Jennifer Lee, who I believe, did she write Frozen? She did. She wrote Frozen, Zootopia, Wreck-It Ralph.
Zootopia.
Yep. Wow, she wrote
a Zootopia was amazing.
Yeah, that was a great, white lady wrote a Black Lives Matter movie. Go ahead,
Jennifer. I know, I was like, okay, Disney, I see you.
Yeah. There we go. So, Aaron, what are your? Have you read the novel?
I have.
Okay. I guess I want your initial thoughts. Talk about what you liked, and maybe after you talk about what you liked, how it compares to your to the novel. Let's do that.
Yeah. Okay. So. The novel is a very interesting read, and I was really concerned with this when they announced that they were doing this movie to begin with, because when I read the book, there were a lot of things that it's a very descriptive book. Mm-hmm. And so when books use a lot of adjectives, I always worry when it's being transcribed into film, because I even told Tim as we sat down to watch it, I was like, I don't know how she's going to pull this off. I was like, because there were some things that they described in the book that I, like, even my imagination couldn't figure out what to do with that information.
Oh, wow.
Ava did such a beautiful job. I told Tim, like, when the movie was over, I was like, as of right now, I was like, I have very few, if any, critiques. And that was primarily due to, and this was actually a little bit of a harder film for me to watch, because I sent him a picture of it afterward, but I swear I looked very similar to Stormy whenever I grew up. And Stormy is the main actress that plays Meg Murray.
Yes.
Down to like the glasses, I was very awkward looking growing up. I've been like this tall since I was in like the fifth grade. So it's one of those things where like I hit a growth spurt and I'm 5'8".
Okay.
And so the whole movie focuses around love and light and, being worthy of that love and appreciation. And it's about her recognition of that in order to fight the darkness. And I told Tim afterward, I was like, you know, I was like, honestly, I was like, as is with a lot of movies that have come out this year, I would have given anything to have a movie like this whenever I was growing up. And I try to explain it to, you know, we all try to explain those things to white people all the time, where it's like, you can't really ever say that, like, you know, like, I know that I'm beautiful regardless of whether or not I see myself in films or on TV. And it's like, well, you can't really say that because you have always been seen in films and on TV. So it's like, you don't really know what it's like when you don't see, like, I never saw families that looked like mine growing up. I never saw women that had hair like mine, or, you know, black actresses that were portrayed as real characters instead of the token black people. And so this year, with so many amazing and, you know, affirming characters coming out that are people of color, it's, you know, it's an amazing time to be in. And I think Ava created a masterpiece that hopefully biracial girls everywhere will look toward and feel that they're worthy of that love and light as well.
Good. Cool. And so in the comparison with the novel, how do you think it measures up?
I actually think she did a really good job. I think that she took some, you know, artistic pleasure in what she created for it. Mm-hmm. But I thought that she did a great job with a book that I feel described a lot of things that every person's brain is going to create or manufacture differently. I thought she covered it across the board with things that would be relatable to any audience member that read the book.
Yeah, because it seems like it, just based on what the critics are saying, it just seems like it's pretty hard. Like it's not an easy thing to extrapolate.
No, what she did was, like, it was very difficult.
Yeah, because, like, you let off in your description, like, it was gonna be, like, I don't know how she's gonna do this. Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, I'm very concerned.
A lot of people, like, I liked it, and I think I liked it for the same reasons that you did. One, I was gonna see it because it's Ava, but the main reason was Gugu and Botha Raw, because, I mean, not, you know, I think she's beautiful, but she is a really good actress who I don't feel like gets that much credit. Or, I mean, maybe she's working, so people are noticing her, but I feel like she should be getting more acclaim than she's getting, because the first time, like, she had that show. God, what was the name of that show? It was her and the pretty guy, the good looking guy.
Her and the pretty guy.
What the hell is his name?
That was probably the working title.
Boris Kodjo. Her and Boris Kodjo, they were in this, there was this remake that they did. Like, they were, like, kind of like thieves. They were like, they did capers together. I'm going to get this. See, every time I try to look, I'm trying to look this up, and I'm looking it up. But it's like, it's giving me this weird, I'm trying to go to her IMDb page.
Google just doesn't want to cooperate.
It's just, okay. Undercovers. It lasted for 13 episodes, and it was a several years into their retirement, a husband and wife are reactivated as CIA agent. Yeah, it's a good, pretty good show. And so that's the first time that was like 2010, and then just seeing her in movies here and there and Beyond the Lights, I think she's phenomenal. I will follow her to the end of the world if she asks me to. It is what it is. But I think she's great. But just as I was watching it, I was just like, I just don't want to feel like, I just think it's an important movie just because of the optics, for the most part. Mm-hmm. Initially, like, the optics of Stormy Reed being the lead girl in the film.
Well, and they've said that, like, she made this movie not for film critics, but she made this as, like, a love letter to biracial and black girls everywhere. Mm-hmm. Like, that's why I think that it's not, and I do think that part of the reason why it's not sitting well with critics is because most critics have not read the books. And I truly think, and I was discussing it with another critic that was at the screening we went to, that if you read the books, like the, you would better understand some of the choices that would seem strange. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say to like an outsider, but like strange to somebody that's not in the Wrinkle in Time zeitgeist, like somebody that doesn't understand why she would choose like this costuming option or why Mrs. Who or Mrs. What should act like this. And I think that if you read the books, like there's a lot more clarity that comes from that.
Yeah. And it's Storm Reed, not Stormy. I'm calling her Stormy. But yeah, like
you're thinking of that other person that's in the news right now.
That's right. Ooh, sorry, folks.
you are better than her.
No, but because the critique that I read from was just that the enemy wasn't bad enough. But what made this interesting was that the struggle was for the most part within herself. Like she had,
yeah, I was like, the enemy is something that lives inside all of us. Like yeah. It can't be, it's only as bad as you make it.
Mm-hmm. And it really reminded me, maybe because I was just so, I mean, I'm coming off of seeing Annihilation, like that it was spreading. It was almost like the shimmer in a way,
yeah.
where it was like she had to stop this. And she's like, well, I want to find my dad. And I think you can, like, with all the fantastical stuff that's going on in this film, it's sort of like, well, at the core of it, the movie's about a girl trying to bring her dad back. She's missing.
Yeah.
This girl misses her dad.
It's about a girl. It's about a girl who has felt invalidated
mm-hmm.
at every turn in life. And yeah. After losing her father, the person who had spent a large portion of her childhood validating her, everything else had gone downhill since then.
Yeah.
So it's about bringing that missing piece of love back into her life.
Yeah. And I agree. I just think, 'cause you know, it's hard. It's like, I just don't want to be all cliche when I talk about it, but I just think, that in and of itself makes this movie important. And then it's weird when you see, like, what is it, like 47% on Rotten Tomatoes now?
Yeah, it's not doing well.
Yeah, 40, actually 42 at the time we were recording. But I don't know, man. I've seen other movies like this and nobody seemed to have a problem with it. It's fine, but I think it's elevated because of the casting. I think it's important for
I'm normally like, as an author, like as somebody that writes, like mm-hmm. I have a really big problem with people that break from canon and decide to go in a completely different direction for physical attributes for characters,
mm-hmm.
because in my mind, I'm like, when you're making an adaptation of something, like the easiest part is casting somebody that looks like the character is written in the books.
Mm-hmm.
However, that is purely subjective upon whether or not the way that they look or appear is part of who they are as a character. If it's not, then I don't care. Do whatever you want. Like, but if they make comments on a person's appearance in the book and that's a large portion of who they are as a character, then yeah, keep it to canon. But I love that she decided to break canon and cast a biracial child in this film, because that is what the majority of families look like in America.
Right.
And I feel like she did it in such a way where I never felt like it was forced. I never felt like I was like, oh, well, these are, you know, it's just another diversity casting thing or whatever. But I felt like she truly depicted and showed what a diverse family looks like today. And I think Chris Pine did a brilliant job. Like, he didn't have like, you know, a ton of lines and everything like that, but I think he did a great job at, you know, depicting an emotional father in these instances. But I thought the whole optional choice that she made was very well done.
Yeah, my only real gripe is I kind of wish her Meg's love interest was a black kid, but whatever.
Yeah, but that is a little different though, because Calvin is like described as a very boy. Tall, scrawny white. Well, he's actually supposed to be a ginger.
Okay.
But I don't know. He was kind of like creepy in this movie. Like, I don't know.
He's like, you're beautiful.
Yeah. He's like, I like your hair. And I'm like, she already told you not to say comments like that. Now you're just being disrespectful.
Yeah. Time's up, Calvin O'Keefe.
Turn away.
Oh man. Sorry. But you know, that was my only, I didn't really have, because it's basic, because what is it, PG? It's PG? Yeah, it's PG. It's PG, a kid's movie.
And I think it's probably PG for like the scary undertones for some of the scenes, probably.
What did you think of Charles Wallace?
I thought he did a great job, especially given how, like, they describe him in the book as this, like, insanely precocious, incredibly intelligent child, and the funny thing is, like, the whole time I was watching the movie, the first thing I could think of was, I wonder how long or how many takes it took this kid to act this role. Like, because he has so many lines, and he, like, even in the book, he has, like, he's a main character of the novel. I know how difficult it was to film Little Rascals. So I was, like, thinking, I was like, I wonder how difficult it was for them to film this.
Yeah.
Trying to get this kid to memorize all of these lines.
He's about 9 years old.
I thought he did a great job, and yeah. I thought he played the character very well, and I thought that he, I don't know whether or not any of these actors or actresses read the books before, but I thought that he portrayed Charles Wallace very well.
Yeah, because it's the standard issue story of everybody believes in you. Like, clearly Charles Wallace believed in her, but she had to believe it. Like, she had to.
Oh yeah, she had to see the power within herself.
Yeah, and that final moment where they showed her looking like her evil doppelganger.
Oh, you can say what I said. I said, oh, you mean the white version of her?
Oh, really? Oh.
She had straightened hair. She was, like, thinner and in traditional, like, I don't want to say traditional Caucasian wear, but she was in clothing that you don't generally see a lot of African-American girls wearing. Okay. She had no glasses. She had makeup on. Like, she was and I say the white version of her because she was the version of her that you would see in, like, an issue of Teen Vogue.
Yeah, like
not like a real version of her.
Yeah, and those other girls, like, she was different from all those other girls that were that was kind of a Benetton ad of girls that didn't like her, right? Were they different ethnicities?
Yeah. No, there was, like, I think the main girl that was the bully looked like she was maybe half Chinese.
Mhm. I
did think that was an interesting twist that Ava decided to do, because they do not do that in the book at all, where they were like everybody essentially, like, that montage where she's like, everybody has a battle that they're facing and you have no idea what's going on, and they showed, like, how she deals with, like, body dysmorphia, and that's why she's a bully.
Yeah, god, they were shitty.
Like, they didn't have that in the book.
I hated those kids. Like, who put your dad's been gone for 4 years? Who does that?
I'm sorry, but I love the fact that she chucked that basketball in her face.
Oh, me too. What I liked about her was that she stood up for herself. She wasn't a victim. Like, she was a victim of that abuse, but she fought back.
Well, and it's like she fought back for Charles Wallace more than anything else, because, like, when she was like, one, like, I can see why your dad left. And she was like, what did you say to me?
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, get her.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, that was really compelling. And you're going to root for this kid. Like, just looking at this kid, you're going to root for her. But, but it was just, I like that tension was just kind of ramped up. To where when you go into the fantastical aspect of the film, where it's just kind of like, okay, like I'm not a huge sci-fi guy, but I think the way that Ava set everything up, it was like, wow, I really like these relationships, and all you really needed to see was that sequence of them, like the dad, like. Oh, this is
the human element.
Yeah, and it was great because, like you said, Chris Pine was great, Gugu was great, and it was just like, okay, and now we have a reason to care about her getting through this journey. So, I would I mean, the more I think about it, I like it a more. You know, it's there's been
the more you marinate in it.
Yeah, like there's. I mean, the best other than Columbus, I would say Coco was the best thing I saw last year, and that moved
me. I didn't see Coco last year.
Damn, oh my God.
No, I didn't see it for personal reasons. Oh. I lost my grandmother. Not too long ago, and I know what the movie's about, and so I was like, I'm not ready to see this just yet.
Well,
so, it is on my list, but I wasn't ready to watch a movie that's like all about losing the matriarch of your family.
I totally understand that. I mean, I've lost, I don't have any grandparents.
She was my first to lose. So.
I totally understand. But that was a beautiful movie that it was unexpected because I went to go see, I was like, oh, people are talking about Coco. I'll see it. Normally I don't see those Pixar movies like right away. But it's beautiful. And I bought it on Blu-ray.
I also, Disney keeps doing those things where they like to like punch you in the gut.
Yeah.
When I saw Inside Out, that wrecked me. Like I legitimately was actually like devastated from it. And I mean, I don't know how like real you want to get on this podcast, but feel free to edit this out.
Aaron, let's keep it real.
Okay. If we're keeping it real, I suffer from clinical depression and PTSD and anxiety. And, that whole movie, I felt like when I got out, I was like sobbing to my ex and he was like, why are you like so affected by it? And I told him, I was like, in a lot of ways, I feel like that movie just put into words how it feels to have depression and not be able to express it. Mm-hmm. And like that movie portrayed so many things that I had tried to tell people what was going on in my head. And it couldn't come out right. Or like they weren't grasping what I was trying to explain to them. Yeah. And that movie like shone a light into all of those like dark little places that you have to like give up or grow up into. Mm-hmm. And it was like, it's like that last scene in Toy Story 3 where all the toys are like holding hands and they're about to like be incinerated. And you're like, well, there goes my childhood. Mm-hmm. That's all dead and set on fire and it's never growing back. It's like those moments where you're like, oh, I actually had to give up a lot of who I was or who I thought I was to be this person that I am now. And Inside Out just destroyed me. Yeah. Absolutely destroyed me. It was so good.
That's a heavy movie. Yeah, it is. It is really good. I don't know. It's a testament to how it is important. Not to mix it. What we do as artists is, but it is influential, and I think to see that makes it even more important when you see people that look like you on screen, and to where this art should be valued, and where I've said this hundreds of times where to as people of color, as minorities. Every weekend when we go to the theater, we're constantly being asked to find humanity in people that don't look like us. And then it seems to be hard for some, not all, but for them to find it in us, unless we're in a position of unless we're subjugated or we're suffering and all that stuff. So
yeah,
I think this movie is very important also, but I think at the same time, I think it is a business, and I wanted to see what you thought about this, since I have you on. So obviously we recommend A Wrinkle in Time. It's to take your black kid, your black daughter to see it. And go see it. It's good. So support, whatever. Anyway. All right.
Yeah.
There was the Hollywood, I believe it was the Hollywood Reporter that posted like Black Panther beats A Wrinkle in Time. And someone quoted that tweet and said, it's not a competition, blah, blah, blah. It's, you know, like they made a making Ava and Ryan Coogler compete against each
enemies.
Other. Yeah. Enemies. But I think that's just the business.
What do you think about that?
Are we being too sensitive or what?
I mean, I think as a person that says, like, it's not a competition, potentially took it in the wrong way. I think they were trying to say, like, two people of color came out with brilliant movies, and one was obviously better than the other, which was not what the whole point of, I'm assuming, what the point of that post was about. It was just essentially about the marketing and the business aspect of it.
Right.
Plus, both of those films are going to cater to completely different audiences.
They're both Disney movies, really.
Like, as much as I would love to bring my kids to Black Panther, I'm not going to bring a kid that is at the age that I would bring them to A Wrinkle in Time to see Black Panther. There's way too much violence and things like that in it. And it's like,
yeah,
I don't think that those are the same audiences at all. I wouldn't, I hate when people are like, oh, you're too sensitive or anything like that. I don't think it's necessarily too sensitive. I think that they potentially either internalized what they were feeling when they read that tweet, or they missed the point of the original tweeter. So I don't think that they were necessarily being too sensitive about the matter. I just think that maybe that the original point behind it was missed, because it is a business. At the end of the day, you do have to have box office profits in order to make an impact in this world. And it sucks that it comes down to that, because like you said, with Columbus, like, a lot of great pictures get, you know, missed and looked over, but at the end of the day, film is a business, and they do care about box office profits. And I know that Black Panther in like less than 30 days grossed $1 billion, and that's an insane accomplishment. Like, I can't even get over it. I still want to go see it like 10 more times, but it isn't a competition. And I even feel like within Hollywood, it's not a competition. Like, it is a business, but you create the best film that you can create and open it up to the world. And just like performing, like you said earlier, it's an insane vulnerability to say, here's this project that I've spent months, hours, you know, sleepless nights, and, you know, living off of coffee and black cigarettes for forever to produce and create this piece of art that I absolutely love, and I'm putting it out there for the world to see. And you hope it does well. Yeah. But I don't think that you are competing with other film directors or producers or styles when it does or doesn't. I think it's just, this is the art that I created, and I hope you like it. Because in the same regard as if you have a theater show that opens up on Broadway, like, think about how many off-Broadway shows that there are opening every single week. You're not competing with others, those shows. You create the best version of the art that you have. And if people like it, it will spread like fire.
Right, right. Yeah, and it's a thing where, like, it's about the numbers. They're gonna do this every week, and just because I think the danger is, like, we don't want Ava to, if the movie doesn't do well, we don't want Ava to not get another movie. But I think what it is that this is a project she chose, because she had a chance to do Black Panther, like, that was offered to her. And she chose this one, and
she chose it for a reason.
Yeah, and she chose it, and it seems like she didn't write the script. Now, if you really, like, this is the thing that I've, and I don't know, like, well, I do kind of know. Well, it's just like with Dee Reese and Mudbound. Like, I don't know if you saw Mudbound. Did you see it?
I didn't get to.
It's. Like, she did.
I have a list of everything that I have missed.
Aaron and her list. My God. No, but this is fine. I'm just giving you shit. This is fine, though. But, like, it's like Mudbound was, like, it was okay. It's an okay movie. Dee Reese did a fantastic movie called Pariah that was amazing. Kim Wayans probably should have gotten nomination. But it's like, don't try to put all this pressure on her when she's already proven herself with, like, Dee Reese did Pariah, which was fantastic. Mudbound, it was like everything that she was supposed to do, she did it. She filmed a big war scene without probably not that much money, and the acting was solid and whatever. The movie, the script wasn't that great. With Ava, she, out of her first time doing a movie of that a lot of people had eyes on, was Selma, and she killed it.
Yeah.
And she should have gotten a nomination. So it's like,
I don't know.
I also feel like she probably feels a lot of pressure in and on herself, though, as not only a female director, but a female director of color. Yeah. Like, there's already a significantly smaller portion of them out there.
Right.
And I know that she feels like she's, you know, somewhat of a flag for our cause. So at the same time, it's like, I don't want to put any extra pressure on her because I already know what she's feeling for herself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's like, yes, it is a business, but at the end of the day, it's still art.
Yeah.
And some art is going to be loved by some and some art is going to be hated by others. Like, it's the nature of the business.
And it's fine. Like, I think this is it's a solid movie. It's good. And I think this movie, it's the same way that I feel about Black Panther, but Black Panther, just even on a larger scale, we're still in it right now. So it's hard to say how it's going to inspire young people. And I think it's going to be, this movie is going to, A Wrinkle in Time is going to do something for it to see a lead like that, a biracial girl. It's going to do something. We might be dead when we see this. I don't know. You never know. Like, it's just,
I hope not.
Well, you know what I mean. You know what I mean. It's going to be years down the line before we really see the.
But even so, like, there were kids in the movie that we saw the screener with, and even they came out changed. And it's like, seeing somebody that even just looks somewhat like you, when you know that the broad amount of media does not, does something inside of you. Like, you immediately feel alive and connected to this person.
Yeah.
Regardless of the script or the outcome of the film, like, I am 27 years old, and I watched a movie that the main character was significantly younger than I am, and I still felt insanely connected to her.
And just to say,
because, like, for once, I got to see myself.
And you're 27, so it took, you're almost 30, and you've yet to see.
And it took this long.
And it took that long. That's what one of my good friends, shout out to Randolph Terrence, who was on the show this week, he said, he's almost 50, and he said to me he's never seen anything like Black Panther before.
Yeah.
So we're in different times. Before we close, though, so this was great to have you on, and I'm so glad we made.
Thanks for having me. I'm honored that you have.
And I'm blushing now, Aaron. I want to talk to you because this kind of just started to bubble up this week. I wanted to get your thoughts on Tiffany Haddish. And the last summer we were praising her. So this was when did Girls Trip come out? This summer, this past summer, less than a year ago. Like, oh my God, Tiffany Haddish, she's amazing, blah, blah, blah. And then after around Oscar season, people started to grow weary of her. And when I say people, I'm talking about Black people. Like, now we're tired of her antics. Not we, but Black Twitter is she's doing too much. She's cooning and she's this. What are your thoughts on as a woman of color? Like, how do you feel about how everything is going?
I think it's a really fine line that we have to walk, because it's sad that we have to present ourselves in a very specific way in order to be accepted by mainstream media. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that I have always loved about Tiffany is that she has seemingly always been herself. And I have her book, Last Black Unicorn, on my shelf. And I really can't wait to read it after I finish the other two books that I'm in the middle of right now.
Okay.
But I feel like she has never once tried to be something that she's not. And in a world where even now people are saying, okay, like, we're already tired of her. Like, in a world where it's constantly forcing you or trying to turn you into something that you aren't, she's a breath of fresh air, in my opinion. She, you know, the fact that she, you know, that ironically, you know, she joked about wearing the same dress to the Oscars, and she did. And it's like, you know, some people are like, that's tacky. You know, like, we have an opportunity to shine our light in this way, so she should be behaving more like this. And it's like, well, why is that the only way to shine light? Like, she's not breaking any laws. She's not, you know, acting ho-ish or anything like that. So why are you upset that she acts in a way that you deem as ignorant? But like you're essentially, it's like when people say, like, oh, I get it all the time. I'm like, oh, I would have never guessed you're black. You just talk so white. And it's like, no, I just talk like an educated individual. And it's like, mm-hmm. we immediately associate certain behaviors and certain indicators with success or, I don't like Caucasianness, I guess is the way that I would say it. And it's like, while Tiffany seems to behave in more of a stereotypical African-American way that like media loves to portray us in, I also think that she's just being real to who she is. Yeah. And I 100% respect her for that. And I would hate to see people trying to take those pieces out of her when she's already in an industry that tries to take everything it can to begin with.
Yeah, it's weird because the same thing that we're praising her for is the same thing now we're folks are trying to take her down for it. It is that's
exactly.
It's just like this self-hate. Like why are we so concerned with the white gaze? And I don't know.
Because we know at the end of the day it still controls everything.
Well, and I think that's a great way to end it. No, seriously, I think that's a perfect
as I
way.
Set everything on fire.
That's hell. Shit, we can end it there. There you go. Aaron, thank you so much.
Hi.
Thank you so much for doing this. This is
and on that depressing note.
No, that's I mean, hey, when you're right, you're right. You know?
We haven't gotten to the point yet where we can be lazy about anything.
White
people have been doing that for centuries, but we can't yet.
I see it. We'll talk about this off mic after we wrap.
Yeah, that'll be another show.
Aaron, I want you to come back. I've already got ideas in my head, but we'll talk about that in a bit. So, Aaron, I'll put all the stuff in the show notes, but plug everything you need to plug.
My name's Aaron. You can find me on Instagram under Essentially Aaron. My name is spelled really strangely. It's E-R-Y-N-N-E. So you can find me at Essentially Aaron on Instagram. EssentiallyAaron.com is my website. It's where I'll be posting film reviews and general blog posts. You've got my Etsy shop, which is Flourish and Inkblot, selling geek cows. If you guys want some of those, you can always just reach out to me, DM. Sometimes I do customized orders, but given that I work 4 jobs, it's really busy and hard to do customized orders all the time, but I love hearing from people, so feel free to reach out.
Aaron, thank you so much. Everybody, thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time.